Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply. ebaymotors.com.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
What's up, you guys? Sean Ross Sapp, Fightful.com. Here with a name. You know, we've interviewed him before on Fightful.
Yeah, you have.
We got Eric Bischoff. Now, I like to kick off my in-persons with a reader question from somebody you absolutely don't know. This one is from a Conrad T. from Huntsville, who asks what your current relationship with liver sausage is.
I love liver sausage. It's a childhood favorite, man.
I feel like I've heard you mention that on your show.
I have. I talked about how growing up as a kid in Detroit, liver sausage was kind of a staple food item. And it's a comfort food. It's like, you know, when you grow up with macaroni and cheese, yeah, or, you know, frozen pizza when you're a kid as a special treat. I look back at it fondly, and every once in a while, I dig me some liver sausage sandwich.
See, I was hoping Conrad would give me something that would, like, fire you up.
No, that just makes me hungry.
Oh, yeah. But I think Conrad knows me well enough to know that I don't do, like, the gotcha interviews, so I don't want to be, like, I don't want to get Eric too fired up, you know. We're here.
It'd be kind of hard to do. I didn't get to bed until about 4 o'clock this morning, yeah, so I'm just barely rolling here.
So I do listen to your show, and I know that you're usually early to rise. We're here in Jacksonville. He was booked for AEW. How was that adjustment when you get booked for something like this and you're up all night? I assume you're partying.
I wouldn't call it partying, but, you know, the show didn't go on until 10 o'clock at night, and my segment was the last segment, so we didn't wrap up until midnight. By the time you get back to the hotel and everybody gets together and, you know, you're still kind of riding that adrenaline high from the show, and, you know, you want to hang out and visit with some folks because at the show, everybody's busy. Everybody's got something going on backstage. You can't really visit. So we did a little bit of that last night, mixed in with a little bit of wine and a good time.
That is a good time. So you've had, I think, 3 or 4 AEW appearances
this
now?
This is my 4th appearance.
Who was in control of, like, sort of contacting you, making this all work?
You know, it's varied. Each one was a little bit different. I think it was the first time it was Tony Khan himself. Chris Harrington, who works with Tony.
He used to write for us.
Yeah. Chris reached out to me once or twice. Cody Rhodes has reached out. Chris Jericho has reached out. So they're all working together. So, you know, I think it's just who has 5 minutes to call Eric and see if he's available kind of thing.
What kind of conversations have you had with Tony Khan? Because you all have been obviously in similar roles in the past, especially working with Turner Networks and stuff like that. What kind of conversations have you all had separate of, hey, can you come in and do this?
You know, we really haven't spent a lot of time, you know, socially. A little bit last night, you know. But, again, people don't realize, you know, and you and I were talking about this before the interview. When you're backstage, especially for a live television show, I mean, it's hectic. Everybody's got work to do. There's, you know, a million things that have to get attended to. And there's always issues and concerns and creative challenges and things like that. So it's very hectic backstage. So when I show up, you know, whether it's WWE or AEW, I just go find a corner. I figure out what I'm supposed to do and when I'm supposed to do it, and I just leave everybody alone. So I don't socialize much.
And you're starting to see, well, I mean, they've been around for a little while, but Tony Schiavone, Sting, Paul sure. White, people that you had worked with in WCW, and of course there are people that you came to know in WWE, I'm sure, across both of your runs there. Has that made that a little bit easier? You're like, you're seeing familiar faces and stuff like this. This isn't like a completely new environment or anything.
Oh, no, no. It's got a real a strong sense of familiarity, you know. Yeah. Not only because of the people, obviously, you know, with Tony and Jim Ross and Sting and many others.
Yeah.
You know, Keith Mitchell, who I've worked with for many, many, many years, you know, WCW and TNA. So there's so many familiar faces. You know, some names that people would recognize, many that people wouldn't on the production side of things. So it's very, very familiar. But just the general vibe, you know, wrestling is still wrestling. You know, the adrenaline, the excitement, the anxiety, all of the above. It's all very familiar.
Oh no!
Oh man!
Oh no!
My brother. My brother.
It's Eric, man.
You want to go ahead and unhook the mic again?
No,
I mean, that's what you do. Oh,
you
boy.
Just scooch on out since you're incompetent.
Jeez.
And I'll handle the rest here.
What are you doing in Jax, baby? What's going on?
Oh, man, I heard this AEW thing going on.
Yeah.
Besides, I knew you were going to be here.
Well.
You know how I love your work.
Well, who fucking doesn't, Eric? Let's be honest here for a second. No, so I just want to ask you a question because somebody
sure.
told me something. I was a little too busy with Dean Malenko. You remember Dean Malenko?
Sure.
Kind of like wildly uncharismatic, like very short. For some reason, whatever. It's fine. It's fine. Were you kind of being a little friendly and chit chatty with Chris last night, or is that just a rumor?
No, that's a rumor, man. Don't believe you've been around the business a
yeah.
long time now.
You've
got your stripes. You know not to listen to rumors.
All right. Thank God. Because, Eric, if that were true.
It'd be disappointing, wouldn't it?
I wouldn't just be disappointed.
What?
And I don't want to do that.
Man,
I don't want to do that, Eric.
You can't beat the shit out of me.
No, Eric, and I wouldn't want to do that.
Elderly.
Dude.
I've got an AARP card in my wallet. How
Eric,
does that make you feel?
Don't talk about yourself like that. You're a goddamn legend. So here's the real question I have to ask.
All right.
You've seen the best of the best in this industry. So here's what I want to know. Have you ever seen someone at the tender age of 25 be this damn good?
No.
There you have it, folks. You can go back to your shitty little interviewer, Shane Race Snap.
That was MJF. He unhooked my microphone one time mid-interview, and I only got the camera mic.
So audio has been a challenge for me on more than one occasion.
Oh, yeah. So we had an honest-to-God Ralphus Chris Jericho situation at the MGM 2 years ago. We were going to film on the floor of the MGM. Well, you can't do that. There's gambling going on there, obviously. So he's like, oh, we'll go up to my hotel room. 35 minutes later, we make it up there. And I'm toting all this stuff, which is heavier even 2 years ago, obviously, because of the advent of technology. And he's got me walking up and down every wing of the MGM, which I didn't realize was that big until I did it. And we stop along one of the mini restaurants, and he's like, hey, hold on a second. And he sees somebody in an AEW hat, and he waits until they notice him, and then when they notice him, he goes, fuck you. And then we then we leave. So, yeah, this is a bit of a tradition now. MJF, though, when you see him, how do you think a guy like that could have fit in and any of the experiences that you would have had from the AWA to WCW to WWE in the 2000s, even more recently?
Honestly, I think as we just seen, he has an incredible gift.
Unfortunately.
You know, and I think in a wrestling industry, when you have that gift, when you can talk, when you can tell a story, when you can create that much heat, or passion, whatever you want to call it, you're going to be successful. He would have been successful in the 90s and the 70s and the 80s and 90s, whatever, because he has a real gift.
He is a real student of the game, too. Like, he will constantly cite the 80s and 90s, like, or 70s even, like, stuff that he went back and watched that a lot of people of his age probably didn't know existed or anything like that. And there are a lot of those lost arts, so to speak. But there have been, as we just mentioned, a lot of advances in technology. And one of my favorite things that I've heard you talk about on your show, 83 Weeks, is how you guys used to have to bring in helicopters and stuff. And now you can get a drone and maybe have an even better shot. What other advances have maybe you seen that you worked on in the 90s and the 2000s that now it's so much simpler? For example, we're filming this on a 4K camera. I don't even know if 4K existed.
You're filming this on a 4K camera that you could put in your glove compartment.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and that's, I think, one of the biggest improvements in technology is just the, not only the quality of the imagery, you know, but just the portability of the cameras. Because cameras used to be something that you had to be a hefty person to be able to lug one of those things around all day. You know, and you battery packs and lighting packs and everything else. You know, it's like you were going into battle. You know, but I think cameras and obviously the editing, you know, processes have advanced along the same lines. But for me, I think it's just cameras, man.
Could you imagine Sting without his tan, but in 4K?
Ooh, that would have been bad.
It would have been bad. I remember when they first started the HD, WDB was like, no more spray tans. No more spray tans. Hey, he's in Jacksonville now. He might win tomorrow night. He might have that tan.
The first thing that when Steve saw me yesterday when I was backstage, I was talking to somebody doing something, and he walked by. He said, hey, nice tan you got there.
You do have a good one. To be fair, you do have a good one. But, I mean, he's in Jacksonville. He's got to be pay-per-view ready, and I'm sure this will obviously come out after the pay-per-view, but you worked a lot with Sting, and during the biggest part of his career, which is saying something, because he's had a lot of big parts of his career. When you look at him and he's had this time off, how are you feeling? Is there any, like, personal concern, like, from a professional perspective?
Oh, no.
Or are you just like, this guy knows he's ready, he's
No. I'm so happy for him, you know.
There he just went.
He just walked by.
There he just went.
We're just talking about you, brother.
We were just talking about the man they call Sting.
No reason to burn. No, we were just talking about what a great career you've had. Have a seat.
We were just talking about this guy. We were talking about your tan. I was like, he's in Jacksonville. He's pay-per-view ready. He's going to be good to go.
It's between Eric and me. Mine is real. His is fake.
Oh!
No, mine's a real tan that comes in a can. It's not a fake tan in a can. It's a real tan in a can.
That's why he was always where he was, and
see, Sting dropping these tan scoops. This is what we came for. This is what we came for. And I was about to mention, I'm sure you're outdoors plenty in the Cody, Wyoming sun. Mm-hmm. That is categorically different than Detroit. At what point did you become like, that's where I want to spend my time, that's where I want to spend my life?
1977, June Ooh. Of 1977. It was the first time I had ever been out west.
Yeah.
Growing up in Detroit as a young kid, you know, in the 60s, you know, Bonanza and the Virginian and Gunsmoke, you know, Rawhide, all those westerns were kind of a staple item in primetime television. And, you know, as a little kid, I just, you know, fantasized about someday going out west because you don't see any mountains in Detroit, you know. And it wasn't until I was about 22 years old, I was 22 years old, that I went out west for the very first time. And I got there and said, this is where I'm going to live someday. I don't know how, but someday I'm going to live here. And fast forward about however many years later, I built a house, and there I am.
Do you think the stark contrast is what drew you to that? Like it was something maybe you hadn't experienced before, and you were like, this is nice. I mean, I'm from Kentucky. When I hit the Midwest for the first time, I was like, land is flat? You can see past right up the street?
Yeah, no, it was different for me because, again, you know, I love to hunt and fish. You know, it was part of my childhood growing up, and the idea of being able to just get on a horse and throw a fly rod in the back and take a ride up a river and, you know, catch fish was like it was a fantasy. And then to experience it as a young man, you know, 22 years old, it was like, okay, I've got to be here. It wasn't so much the stark contrast as much as it was the idea of being able to spend so much time outdoors and enjoying it.
Now you get to hang out with Kanye West all the time, right?
I don't know, man. I think Kanye left town. I think since
really?
I'm not sure. I haven't seen or heard of him, so.
You got to get that TMZ presence out there in Cody, Wyoming.
You got to keep it alive, right?
You're going to see paparazzi just roaming around.
No, there's a big celebrity golf tournament, softball tournament coming up June 16th. So Hacksaw Jim Duggan's coming into town.
Oh, that's great.
Ernest Miller and Sonny Ono and a bunch of baseball players and football players and should be pretty fun. So we'll miss Kanye.
Yeah.
Harrison Ford's going to be there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's coaching one team. I'm coaching another. So
I love it. I
get
love
to
it.
Go head-to-head with Han Solo.
Speaking of music, obviously your WDB theme, pretty iconic. Did you ever meet the people who did, like, the lyrics to it, the composition?
No, I never did.
I was always – because obviously it's a bit of a play off of AC/DC and mm-hmm. all that. But I always wondered about that because, for example, like – Victoria, Nicki Minaj sang her song years before she blew up, and I was always surprised. There is a bit of a disconnect there because sometimes these are songs that have been made years and years before, right?
Yeah, I don't know what the process was with my song. I know when I first came out, when I was first introduced in WWE, they actually used AC/DC's Back in Black. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. They're just going to spend a couple bucks on that, but it was a one-time only.
Yeah.
And then they came up with something that sounded similar, but I never met the people involved.
How did they tell you that? Did they tell you ahead of time, hey, we're using AC/DC?
No, I didn't know anything, man.
Wow.
I didn't ask any questions. They didn't give me any information. I just showed up and it played. It was kind of cool.
That is fantastic. I love that. And so when they switched it, did they say, well, we're going to switch it? Or was that another surprise when you came out?
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I didn't really notice it.
Wow.
You know, because for me, when I get my head in a weird zone, you
sure.
know, I try to, and there's so much going on that it's just noise. It's like static noise in the background. I don't really hear it the same way the people at home hear it, or maybe even the people in the arena hear it. So I didn't even really notice it until I got home and watched it on television. I'm like, oh, wow, that's a different song.
Speaking of watching it on television, I've said this multiple times. I learned more about North Korea from you and Scott Norton than I did from my public school system. Like, I literally...
That's not surprising.
I mean...
It says a lot for the public school system.
Yeah.
They all suck,
and
by
hey,
the way.
It says a lot about you and Scott Norton, his book, full of
you
information.
You can call me professor.
Yeah, there you go. and The Dark Side of the Ring released. And I had watched a couple documentaries or short video pieces that kind of primed me for it ahead of time. But... This is such a wild topic, North Korea, and it got me to learn more about North Korea. I watched other Vice documentaries about it, and it is such a unique situation. Have you had any type of negative feedback regarding that? Because, for example, Seth Rogen, James Franco had a pretty wild North Korea-based movie a few years ago. They had to take it out of theaters, put it on streaming.
That.
Like, do you ever get anything like that? Like, anything abrasive or angry in regards
no.
to that?
No. And, you know, it very rarely comes up unless it's in the context of a wrestling conversation. You know, the average person doesn't know that I went over there. But it was such a fascinating trip and experience, you know. And if you want to know what North Korea's like, we're getting a good look at it here in this country. Because, you know, what used to be news is now quickly becoming propaganda.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's across the board. I'm
yes.
not picking on any one outlet or any political party. It's all becoming so muddied and politicized and weaponized that we're not getting news and information. We're getting propaganda.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, one of the things that when I experienced in North Korea is, and it's hard for us as Americans or anybody that's grown up in a relatively free society or free country to really understand how much impact propaganda can have on
yes.
people. When those people, you know, I referred to the, you know, people when I went jogging through the streets of Pyongyang, North Korea, they had absolute terror in their eyes. And I mean that. And there's a difference between people, you know, you look at somebody and they're kind of uncomfortable with you, or you can tell they just don't want to be around you. That's one thing.
Yeah.
Terror is something completely different. And it's actually frightening to see. And they were so terrified of my presence because of the propaganda that they had been taught for years and years and years. And I'm going to go off on a little bit of a tangent here because it didn't get covered in the Vice episode. But there was a moment when, as the North Koreans were touring us around Pyongyang and seeing all the sights and paying homage to the dear leader and all the things they wanted us to do for publicity reasons, or propaganda reasons, I should say, they took us to what is basically a replica of the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, right? And they told us this history of this monument that was built to honor the 50,000 dead North Koreans who perished at the hands of American bombers. And, you know, I don't know how much of that is true, if a little bit of it is true, not true, whatever. But during that conversation, the person who was taking us on this tour and telling us about this monument proceeded to tell us that the North Koreans defeated the Japanese in World War II. The military leaders in North Korea don't know anything about World War II. They only know the North Korean version of it. They're taught from a very young age. Now, I'm 66 years old, and the military leaders that are over there right now in North Korea, a majority of them are younger than I am, and they know even less about what really happened in World War II. So now you've got a country with nuclear warheads who have no idea what history really was because they've been taught a fabricated version of that. And the same thing is happening in this country. So it's, if you want to know what North Korea is like, just kind of look around you because we're getting there.
Did you, like ahead of time, did you all get like a bit of a primer? Like, were they saying, don't spew your propaganda here or anything like that? Or don't try to change the minds of anybody?
No, there was no prep by anybody.
I wondered if they were just like, hope it doesn't come up. That's how it'll work.
You mean North Koreans?
Yeah, I was the people that were bringing you over specifically. I had wondered if they were like just hoping that the subject of, hey, that's not how that happened.
Up. No, you know what? No, because we knew. Look. When we got off the plane, the first thing they did was take your passports.
Oh yeah.
So the message was clearly sent that they are in control. And you got that message a lot, loud and clear the minute we got off the airplane. And then shortly after we got off the plane and we got segregated into cars, you know, two people to a car, we had handlers who essentially gave us the rules of the road. And I was told specifically that my handler was a female, North Korean, their version of Secret Service, I guess. And she turned around and looked at me and she said, "Now, whatever you do, don't rape our women."
Oh, my God.
Sonny Ono was sitting next to me, and I looked at Sonny, and I'm thinking, did she just... She goes, yes.
She was very nice about it.
She's, matter of fact, you cannot rape our women. And I thought, well, okay.
Yeah.
Here, let me make a note of that, you know. So you got the impression right away that...
If only you had phones back then, you could have a reminder constantly, like, please don't do that.
No, but you knew right off the bat that they were in total control.
Yeah.
And the message was loud and clear.
Two Cold Scorpio versus Hawk, straight up, no substances involved. Who would win that fight?
I don't know, man. That's silly shit.
Oh,
I don't want to get into it. I heard Scorp, and I don't know Scorp real well. I didn't know Hawk real well. I knew him fairly well. I wouldn't want to call that one. Hey, man. I wouldn't have wanted to call that one.
Man, that one would have been... I mean, two very tough dudes. I'll say, based on what I saw in Brawl for All, which I don't know if... Did you watch Brawl for All as it happened?
No.
Because I wondered, because, I mean, you were a competitive fighter. You know what good technique is and what bad technique is. There's a lot of bad technique there. Like, the best technique I think I saw was from The Godfather. Like, he would keep his elbows in. Like, he would throw punches like a fighter would. And there were people that... Like, obviously, Dan Severn, like, one round in, he's like, this isn't worth my time. And Blackman was like, this isn't worth my time. And then by the end, it was throwing from the hip and all that. And I was shocked as a kid because even I had heard, like, Hawk's this bad dude. And I don't know if it's because he was in a bad place, but I was watching all these fighters, and I was like, I know this isn't how you're supposed to throw a punch. And I was like 12.
I think, you know, guys that get reputations that are good street fighters.
Mm-hmm.
Those are 15-second fights,
30-second
fights in a bar. you know, surrounded by a lot of people or out in a parking lot.
And if Hawk wraps you up and dumps you on your head, that's it.
There's a difference between a 15 or a 30-second fight, you know, where people are pulling you apart, and a two-minute round or three-minute round. And that's where you can see the difference in techniques and who has it and who doesn't have it.
Was there anybody that you've seen within wrestling, like outside of the Ernest the Cat Millers, who are like, man, so well-traveled and have these accolades, that you looked at and you're like, oh, their technique, that's pretty good. Didn't necessarily expect that or anything of that nature.
You know, I think Rick Rude, was legitimate. You know, he was a legitimate boxer, had a legitimate boxing skills. But beyond that, now not that others didn't have it.
Yeah.
But you don't see it in the context of a wrestling match. They're two different things.
There are so many people like that wrestled in the 90s, like Craig the Pitbull Pittman. Like, he had a couple MMA fights, and obviously Jerry Flynn.
Well, he was a great amateur wrestler.
Yeah, he was. And there are some more, like Ludwig Borga, who did terribly. Like, he got lit up by Randy Couture, as most people would, within like 15 seconds. So, obviously, I mean, there are some people that carry that and some people that don't. And when you were... You had left, I know, the competitive days behind, but you had sort of transitioned in with the game that you talk about, you and Sonny Ono selling, which I thought that's probably my favorite episode of your podcast, because I didn't know anything about the AWA, didn't know anything about the game. Like, what was that a bit of a transition? Like, was there anything that you took from competitive fighting days and that you saw in WCW and you're like, maybe you can implement a little bit of that into this?
Not at all.
Really?
No, it's... Two different things, man. One's a storytelling art form, and the other one was combat.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, people draw parallels a lot between MMA and professional wrestling, and I don't get that at all. It's silliness. I think the only commonality is, you know, there's a ring of sorts.
Yeah.
But that's about the beginning and end of it.
And, I mean, there were rumors that WWF wanted to do something like that in the 90s, like the World Karate Federation. Or something like that. Was that something you had gotten wind of at the time, or is that something you had heard since, like, from the Conrad shows?
No, it's something I had heard, you know, at the time, and it was an interesting idea to me. I've known people that have tried that for a long time. When I was active in martial arts in the late 70s, the group that I was training with and was an instructor with eventually, they worked with CBS Sports. They worked with ABC Sports. We're involved with a couple fights on Wide World of Sports and things like that. So people, Joe Corley, the Professional Karate Association out of Atlanta, Georgia, had made great inroads into, you know, getting television back in the late 70s. But they could never get themselves organized. You know, everybody was fighting over money and prestige, and nobody really cooperated enough to pull it off. But I had heard about it, was interested in it.
So as we wrap up, obviously 83 weeks, Conrad Thompson, he's got an empire. He even took time out of his busy schedule to submit that liver sausage question too. How have things changed for you? How have you noticed that perception has maybe even changed now that people get to hear your side of things after so long?
No doubt. It's completely different, you know, because for a long time, you know, the peripheral media as I refer to them.
Not me.
Not Sean. I've never, ever included you in that category.
You say nice things about me. I really appreciate it.
Well, that's because you do a good job.
Thank you.
And there's a difference, though, because you give your opinion. Mm-hmm. You talk about, you know, your perspective and all that, which is entertaining. I enjoy listening to it. And I check it out often. But there's a fine line between, you know, stating your opinion and stating your opinion as a fact.
Like what MJF did earlier? Like him? Like, is he the peripheral media? You
no,
know
he's
what?
Not.
If it wouldn't shock me to see like Webb is MJF or something like that, where he's running his own propaganda wrestling news site.
Yeah, I'm sure
he won't know the difference between your and your, but he'll have his own website.
But now that, you know, because of podcasts and, you know, people like me have platforms and we can give our side of the story. Bruce Pritchard can get his side of the story, and Arn and JR and Tony and so many people. And even outside the Conrad Thompson podcast empire, people now have the ability to go, I'm calling bullshit on that and give their perspective. And I think it's a healthy thing. And as a result of that, I think people have a different perspective on at least my side of the story, and they can do with it what they want. They can believe it, not believe it, whatever. But at least, you know, it's out there now.
And it's a good show. I mean, I listen to it weekly. I specifically love hearing about how you sort of wade through the waters of sponsorships and managing that as it relates to pay-per-views and shows and all that. There are so many aspects of the business that I think a lot of people didn't realize. Oh, yeah, Eric did that, and he would have done this, and he would have done that. Is there any of that that you miss at all, or are you like, man, that's in my rear view?
There are certain aspects of the business that I do miss. You know, I love working with younger talent. I love teaching people how to do good promos,
yeah,
and communicate and find their characters. That part of it I do miss. I do not miss the travel.
Yeah.
You know, I don't miss the talent-related issues. You know, managing talent is tough. Nobody's ever 100% happy, and nor should they be. You know, everybody's striving to become the next best version of themselves. So you get about 100 of those people in a room, and it can be kind of tiresome.
Yeah.
So I don't miss that part.
So, I mean, as we're filming this, this is like one of the first events with fans. We're filming this Double or Nothing weekend, Jacksonville. That probably means you're about to start traveling with Conrad more, I would imagine.
You know, we've talked about that. I think we're going to do some live shows, but both of us have gotten fairly busy, you know, and it's just hard, especially for
me. I don't think Conrad's that busy. I don't think he's
that
busy.
Either. No, he's just running this little mortgage company over here. And,
yeah.
You know, he's got this, you know,
37
podcast. Is it 42 now? I thought it was 37 when I left
like
Cody.
That.
It'll probably be 42 by the time I get
yeah.
home. But, you know, we'll do some shows, but I'd like to stay home as much as possible.
Another thing I've always wondered, you've often mentioned Nitro Thunder and how Bret Hart came in, and that was a part of expanding things, so to speak. Were there ideas for, like, a specific brand split, or was it, like, thematic shows? Was it going to be, I know you had mentioned WCW Thunder and NWO Nitro. Mm-hmm. Was it going to be, like, a modern-day brand split, or was it just, well, we wanted to have this wealth of talent, that way those shows wouldn't be redundant?
No, it was going to be a formal brand split. There would have been a moment, an event, something would have happened, and WCW would have been designated as a, because at that point it would have been clear that the NWO and WCW guys could not play well together,
sure,
under any circumstances. So to resolve that issue, WCW was going to get their show, Nitro was going to get, or NWO was going to get their show, and then we would have occasional crossovers.
So we would sometimes see, like, on WCW Saturday night, you'd see Six kicking the shit out of somebody while Nick Patrick with a mask on was reffing.
No, you wouldn't see that on WCW Saturday night.
Well, you would see it.
That would have been a completely different roster.
Okay, no, I meant, like, we did see that a couple of times.
Oh, you did see it.
Yeah, we did see that a couple times. But so that would have been more in line with what NWO Nitro would have been compared to what we would it have been like different presentations, different production styles?
They would have looked and felt differently. You know, WCW would have been a more traditional wrestling show because the WCW audience, the core audience, was a more traditional wrestling audience. They were NWA, you know, they were Georgia Championship Wrestling. They were Florida Championship Wrestling, you know, back before cable television. A lot of that heritage was still a part of the WCW audience. So that show, the WCW show, would have had a more traditional feel to it. NWO would have been a more edgy, kind of black and white and grainy.
I'm just so fascinated by that because it's like that it happened, but it happened years later, categorically different with the WWE brand split because they acquired that ECW and WCW talent. So to see, and I mean, I remember like playing the video games and I would flip to that roster and I'm like, oh my gosh, this WCW roster is huge. Like, and I even thought then, I was like, my gosh, they could do a completely different roster with just half these guys. So to hear in the years that followed, like, that was the plan. That's what was going to happen. Do you remember what specific moment happened when you were like, that's not going to happen?
Sure. You know, it would have been, it's hard for me to pinpoint the date, but it would have been somewhere, it was in the summer, 97, maybe 98, when the AOL Time Warner thing was all going down. Once they started moving budgets around, once they started cutting my budgets and telling me what I could and couldn't do, after I had been given the responsibility of launching an entirely new show, I had to pay for it myself. You know, TBS didn't want to pay for Thunder. So in addition to having to pay for that show, they were also cutting my budget simultaneously. At that point, I knew that we weren't going to be able to do any of the things that we had originally planned to do.
Yeiston here. More great stories like this on 83 Weeks with Eric Bischoff. Eric, thank you so much. This is the first time.
Thank you, man.
First time I met you. Hopefully, not the last time I interviewed you. I'm hoping I don't become a part of the peripheral media.
No, you're doing a great job.
Guys, until next time, we're out.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.